for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. As a doctor and writer, Atul Gawande has devoted himself to finding ways to improve the practice of medicine. In his new book, titled The Checklist Manifesto, he writes, quote, "Even the most expert among us can gain from searching out the patterns of mistakes and failures and putting a few checks in place." Dr. Gawande is a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, an associate professor at Harvard Medical School, and a staff writer at The New Yorker. He joins me in the studio, and throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your questions and comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org, and you can also join us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to you, sir. It's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
As I was reading through your book, it seems to me that you and President Obama are on the same wavelength regarding not only national health reform, but national security.
Well, that's interesting, because with this most recent terror incident, the difficulties with pulling knowledge together that exists has come up again and again. And I started thinking about this problem, of course, from my surgical world. I had to take on a project where we were looking at how we could reduce deaths in surgery. And when we looked at the patterns, it was the same kind of pattern. We lived in a world for a long time where ignorance was our biggest issue in medicine and in many lines of work. But now, with knowledge having accumulated to the point that we have volumes of it, the people at the front lines can't connect the dots and make it come together. And what we ended up turning to is the idea that, you know, as experts, you just train and train and train. You try to get more technology. As a surgeon, we're now going through 8 to 10 years of training to come through, and yet we still have failures. And in the terrorist incident, what you saw was people didn't pull the threads together. What people, we turned to ideas from other fields. And when we looked at aviation, looked at how skyscrapers are constructed, the pattern of how people succeed under conditions of complexity was really low tech, and that surprised me. It was turning to things like checklists.
And checklists, things that we do every single day in our own lives, in our own homes, are what you are now urging doctors, hospitals, and even the President of the United States to urge on his top security people to begin to follow, make and follow more carefully.
Yeah, it sounds like a really slight thing to be talking about. And I never thought I'd be writing a book about checklists of all things. But as we try to reform healthcare, for instance, what we can lose sight of is that our deepest struggle isn't over the money issues, and it isn't over the insurance hassles in medicine. It's over complexity. We now have 6,000 drugs we've discovered, 4,000 medical and surgical procedures, and those of us at the front lines are trying to make sure that we're matching the information and the needs of the patient to the right panel of things. Well, in surgery, what we did was we decided to try this counterintuitive thing for experts. Experts hate checklists. But,
sure.
But we came up with a checklist. We implemented it in 8 hospitals for
surgery. I want to ask you something.
Yeah.
Why do you think it is that experts hate checklists?
Oh, it is. There's a couple things. Using a checklist is felt to be a sign of weakness by an expert. The whole reason you go through all this training is so you don't have to use checklists. Checklists are for low-status, untrained people. But the trouble is that when the volume of knowledge exceeds the capacity of your brain, and that is what has happened in multiple fields over time. Aviation turned to checklists when planes got four engines on them, and they found that pilots were making basic errors that were killing people because they would forget to check this or that on one engine or another that was critical for making it work. So 75 years ago, the Army instituted the first checklist before takeoff, and that has been a critical part of the transformation of flying. A pilot today wouldn't think of getting in a plane without a checklist. And yet in surgery, when I operate, we didn't normally have a doctor's checklist. There are checks that the nurses would make and checks that other folks might make. But would I check that antibiotics were given on time? Would I check that blood is available? Would I check that we've really briefed the team on the medical history of the patient before I put that knife to skin? Would I have a piece of paper that we would read off as a team and verbally go through the checks? We didn't have that habit. But when we instituted it in 8 hospitals, we tried it in 8,000 patients, published the results in the New England Journal of Medicine a year ago, and we reduced the deaths in that population 46%.
That must have just amazed you.
Yes, I expected we would get some gain out of it, but what really surprised me about it was we did this test in the poorest parts of the world, in rural Tanzania, in Delhi, and in hospitals in the richest parts of the world. Some of our best hospitals, University of Washington in Seattle, University of Toronto, St. Mary's Hospital in London. And every hospital experienced a double-digit reduction in major complications. And the reason why is that when we think we've got the dumb stuff out of the way, there's so many ways in which things can go wrong in an operating room that you don't expect it. I started using the checklist in part because I didn't want to be a hypocrite. I was asking people in all of these hospitals to use checklists. I thought it would help in rural Tanzania or in New Delhi. But did I need it at Harvard? No. We've been working hard on, I know what I'm doing. We put the checklist in. It has some interesting components, not just make sure blood and things and antibiotics are available, also make sure everybody in the room knows each other's name.
Why is that important?
There was a study at Johns Hopkins trying that kind of idea that demonstrated what they called an activation phenomenon, that when you have teams of people having to do complex work, that they function in their own silos until you let them say their name. When I'm in a hospital with over 45 operating rooms, I'm constantly working with people I haven't worked with in months, often forget their name, but you don't want to quite admit it. And when people, like even a medical student, have a chance to hear their name spoken out loud, to say it, they're much more likely to later on raise a concern. They'll say, are we sure that that's okay? Something that they wouldn't necessarily think of. And from the very first week I started using the checklist, we have not gotten through a week where it didn't catch something. Someone would say, was that antibiotic given? I think we got to get, we're putting it in right now. Or the anesthesiologist would say, do you have any concern? We would say, do you have any concerns before we start? And they would say, no, I assume we've taken care of this woman's plans for her breathing problems. And I would say, what breathing problem? How did I not know about her obstructive pulmonary disease? And then we would change the plans and make sure we had things in place to be prepared.
Dr. Atul Gawande, he has written a new book. It's titled The Checklist Manifesto. Pardon me. He's also the best-selling author of Better and Complications. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. In the book, you describe the remarkable story of a 3-year-old girl who drowned. Tell us about that.
This was influenced me as a case report where they were outlining how do you save a drowning girl, and described a 3-year-old girl who was went down in a frozen pond. Parents lost sight of her. She went into the pond under the water and was lost for 30 minutes. they finally found her on the pond bottom. You can imagine how terrifying this is. She was not breathing. Her heart had stopped. Her temperature was 66 degrees, which is 30 plus degrees below normal. Pupils dilated and fixed. She was basically gone. But no one gives up on a three-year-old girl. They started CPR. They got her to a hospital by helicopter. And when you outline the steps involved in what is required to save a drowning girl, they had to put her on cardiopulmonary bypass, which means opening the blood vessels in the groin of her leg, feeding inflow and outflow lines to a bypass machine, and getting the bypass machine going. When they did that, they were able to warm the body, but it took 2 hours total from the time she'd gone underwater with no oxygen. Then her heart came back. Next, they had to bring the lungs back.
Wow.
That took another 24 hours, took an open sternotomy.
Because
they had to plug a new line.
Because her lungs were filled with debris.
Pond debris,
yeah.
Water. They were doing suction and bronchoscopy. Then they were able to bring her lungs back. There was the work to get her liver back, her kidneys back. She then had brain swelling. To prevent her brain from having permanent damage, they had to drill a hole in her skull, release pressure, put pressure probes in. And what fascinated me about this was that she pulled through. After 2 years of occupational and physical therapy, it did not end in the hospital. She then tested at age 5, neurologically normal. And what it explained to me was, it's not like ER. It's not just a matter of a few chest compressions and you can bring them back.
You follow a checklist. Atul Gawande will be right back. Welcome back. I'm sure many of you know the name Atul Gawande from his writings in the New Yorker magazine. He's also a surgeon at Harvard, at Boston Women's Hospital in Boston, and he's a professor at the Harvard Medical School. And he is the author of a brand new book. It's titled The Checklist Manifesto, How to Get Things Right. On the cover is a great big red check. Just before the break, we were talking about this three-year-old girl, this extraordinary story, and what you are saying with the use of that story is that each of those professionals had to follow a certain way of doing things and make sure that each step of the way, everything was covered.
When the report was published, they didn't mention how they got the hospital to pull this off. So I called up the author and I said, how did you guys do that? It was in a small community hospital. And it was a hospital in the mountains where they had avalanches every year, which would take a half dozen to a dozen people out. And they would have people come in frozen and cardiac arrest, and they would lose them every year. None of them were saved. And he was convinced that they had the knowledge of how to save them. And what he found was the problem was speed. There was always something that got dropped along the way. And so he didn't publish it, but what he really did in that study was they made a checklist and asked everybody to follow through. And the interesting thing is they gave it to the person with the least power in the whole equation, the telephone operator at the hospital, who then, when a call would come in from 911 that they had one of these cases coming in, would go down the list, which mainly was make sure you got the engineer involved to get the cardiopulmonary bypass ready, make sure that the anesthesiologist is driving in. They can't be 40 minutes away at home. They got to be driving in now. Make sure you got the trauma team gathered. Make sure you have cardiac surgery gathered. And then each of them had to go through their checks. And that's when they had that girl, which was their first save. And they've had multiple saves since then. And it's as if we only wanted to look at the technology. We miss the reality that great medicine, and actually, by the way, doing something about our costs, is about making a system of components work together in ways that are functional. And I feel like that's been partly missing in our health reform debate and missing in our larger understanding of our problems in coping with the volume of knowledge in many lines of professional work.
Now, we've been told that your articles, your books are required reading at the White House. Have you spoken with the president personally about health care reform?
You know, I've never met him or corresponded or gotten to talk to him. I would look forward to that someday. But in a funny way, I feel like I've had my meetings with him better than I would have. Because I've had a chance to see the articles be read by his staff and himself and start to see the arguments influence the idea that making healthcare better, making it safer, higher quality, and lower cost is not just about insurance changes. It's about making it possible at the front lines to develop these kinds of solutions. One of the ironies of this? A checklist costs no money, which means it makes no revenue. If we had a drug that could reduce major complications of surgery by one-third, there would be ads on television. You'd have celebrities going on saying, buy my drug. Instead, it's just a checklist. And so how many hospitals are using the surgical checklist we devised, published over a year ago? It's less than 20%.
Ah. Now, what can you do about that?
This is where reform and ideas like this are important. Children's Hospital, a head of a children's hospital I spoke to, came up with a checklist for an asthma program that just made sure they got the act together for treating kids with asthma, and they reduced their admissions 80% for kids with asthma. Guess what their number one revenue and admissions are? Kids with asthma. And he realized their program was going to devastate their hospital. Now, reform is about changing us from a fee-for-service system that makes these kinds of bad choices a problem. But we lament that the bill, you know, where's the master plan for doing this in the bill? We're all frustrated that cost control hasn't, the answer's not in there. And the reason why is what would be the way we should change this? Well, there are experiments with offering different ways of paying doctors and hospitals to try to make these changes. And that's the first foot forward that I think we have to make. So leading to a world where we do the right thing as teams of people, make sure that half dozen steps happen, is about thinking of our system as well.
Here's an email from Stephen, who says, I'm a U.S. Army officer who's used pre-combat checks and pre-combat inspections. We consider these checks absolutely critical for mission success. We use them religiously. Lately, I've been trying to develop some simple lists for my elementary school kids for school preparation. They're not as enthusiastic as I. But isn't that interesting?
It is, and I'm really fascinated by that lack of enthusiasm. There was a study I looked at. A psychologist studied venture capitalists, and When venture capitalists make a major investment, multi-million dollars on some crazy idea, the hard part isn't getting good ideas. The hard part is finding people who can execute on good ideas. And he found multiple kinds of personalities, ranging from what he called the art critic, who just takes a good look at a person and says, I know this person will be great, to people who use checklists, going through to make sure they've systematically made sure that they have the best possible person in their hands. And guess which group of people had the highest returns on investment, the lowest rates of failure? It was the checklist folks. And guess which was the least popular way for venture capitalists to use the checklist approach? Only 13% used it.
Here's an email from Judy. She says, does the doctor suggest that if doctors themselves don't embrace the idea of a checklist for procedures and patient interactions, that patients themselves should create or be provided with their own version of similar checklists and require their doctors to complete before procedures or doing office visits?
I think patient checklists could be very powerful, especially at some critical risk moments in care. In a sense, having a little check in your head, did my doctor or nurse wash their hands before they came in, is about trying to stop 2 million infections that spread through hospitals per year. At the time of discharge, we know there are two or three key things that hospitals should do that prevent people from bouncing back into the hospital, but we don't consistently do. For example, making sure the patients really understand, have gone through the list of drugs that have been changed in their care, and also making sure they actually have an appointment to see a doctor within 2 weeks after their discharge from the hospital, actually have it set up. They know the time and the place. That when we miss a couple of steps like that, 2 weeks later you have people who weren't on the right medications, didn't have anybody check on them, and they're back in an emergency room sicker than they were to begin with.
Also, simply walking into a doctor's office with your own checklist of questions, it seems to me, helps that patient gain an understanding and take charge of his or her own illness.
Yes. There's no question we're moving to a world where we've got to learn to be better partners
in
the work. The hard part here is, I try to imagine, I'm getting on an airplane and they're not using a checklist. And so am I going to trot up front and say, hey, here's this checklist. Can you guys try it right now? A lot of the idea is not just having a piece of paper you throw in front of people. It's about inculcating certain habits of discipline in the way we attack problems. As experts, you want to believe we'll hold it all in our head. And when you're seeing a patient in an office visit, a recent study that we did showed that the average physician has more than 300 new diagnoses they have to deal with in a year, which is a ton of information to have to hold in your head. And we just have to realize, the way pilots do, we're fallible, we're going to fail, and therefore we need to check. And the pressure from the public is going to have to be on our sense of self-discipline, because the public can't do all the checks for us.
So since you have found that only 20% of the hospitals to which you've suggested this idea have come aboard, is it that the doctors themselves are totally resistant? Is it the nurses? What's going on here?
There's two things that are happening. Number one, we implemented it in my hospital at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. It took us 5 months, because what you have to do is get the surgeons, the anesthesiologists, and the nurses all talking together and agreeing on what goes in the checklist, and then to use it, do a little bit of practice and training. We never had meetings where we got everybody together to do that. We functioned in our own specialty silos, and it took us 3 months just to gather that kind of organizational capability. I think that there's a second level to this, which is that we have a hard time recognizing that it's not just about taking this checklist that this guy, Gawande, came up with. It's also that we can apply this idea in multiple areas in medicine. I had a friend with depression who for 3 years went through depression medication change after medication change. They couldn't find anything that would work. And then they realized they hadn't checked her thyroid hormone levels. And all it was a thyroid hormone deficiency. A pill took care of it within 2 weeks, and she'd lost 3 years. Now, that kind of gap is routine, and it's because we haven't developed the discipline ourselves of having those kinds of checks. It has to do with our conception of ourselves as experts, not just in medicine, that's of course what I know, but in law, in business, in government, and the places where we see these problems. It's not about central control either. It's not, if we make rigid checklists that just become checkbox exercises, we fail. This is about making aids that help experts be better than they were.
What about nurses and their relationship to doctors? Can nurses put certain checks on doctors themselves?
Part of this is a power shift in a certain way. One of my colleagues at Johns Hopkins came up with a checklist to reduce infections in ICUs that just had to do with making sure when intravenous lines go in that the doctor washes their hands, puts sterile hat, mask, glove, gown on when you're doing it in the ICU, sterile drape over the patient. But the check really required a nurse and a doctor to go through the check together, and that meant giving the nurse the power to say, halt, you don't go forward with that procedure because we missed a couple steps. The moment that the doctor yells at the nurse and an administrator in the hospital instead gets the nurse in trouble, that's the end of that checklist. It was changing the power relationship so that a nurse could be allowed to say, I think we have a problem here.
Now, how widespread is that procedure?
That checklist was instituted in the state of Michigan. Within 3 months, reduced their infection rate by 2/3. The worst hospital in Michigan has a lower infection rate from lines in their ICUs than 90% of American hospitals, and it's been out for 3 years. Have we implemented this in every state in every hospital in the country? No. We probably are over 2/3 or something like that. We're getting there. People have not yet recognized the power to both save dollars, $200 million in that state, or make a difference.
Atul Gawande, his new book is titled The Checklist Manifesto, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Grand Rapids, Michigan, and to Sunny. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you both. I have a two-part question. First, if you have a physician or a surgeon who is not using a checklist, is there a kosher way to request that they do use some type of a checklist that you think would, or that they think would be helpful in avoiding medical errors? And secondly, would it be possible to employ a medical sales force, maybe employed by the NIH, to go to the different hospitals and surgeons and sell the benefits of this proven checklist?
I've been thinking long and hard about this, and you know, on the one hand, showing surgeons the checklist and having patients simply give it to them and say, "Is this the kind of thing you use?" You know, our checklist is available. It's with the World Health Organization. We have it on our website, www.safesurge.org. But I think people are more and more aware of it. The hard part is it isn't about just having that piece of paper in the operating room. To make it work means that people, even at the systems level, they have to recognize that for the antibiotic to be given consistently before incision, some of the hospitals had to make sure that pharmacy supplies had it in the operating room at the right time. Making sure that everybody on the team is briefed one another, getting through that social dynamic of getting everybody to pause in the right way, build it into their routine, and make it happen at the right moment that it doesn't actually harm care. I describe in the book a moment where we implemented it in my operating room, and I found we were doing it in a poor way, and it actually was distracting us from the patient. You can have good checklists, and you can have bad checklists, and you can have ones that get in the way. And so getting us to that point where we take it seriously and adopt it as professionals is tough to do, but I like the idea of patients simply offering it to their doctors and saying, Are you using this? Can we use it? It almost, I think the most important place to have people make a difference is to ask the hospitals to use it. But I want it to go further. It's exactly like you explain, a kind of sales force going out there, not just for providing this particular checklist. We have 4,000 medical surgical procedures, 6,000 drugs. We really need these kinds of checks devised by clinicians themselves with what they consider their best practices for anything that we want to do. In other words, we all have intentions about what we want to do as professionals, but until we have made a little check for ourselves, we know we will have things falling through the cracks.
We're talking about a book titled The Checklist Manifesto. Atul Gawande is with me, and in the next segment, we are going to take more of your calls, your email. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, George Lucas, the man behind Star Wars, has a new book out, a book that looks at the biggest movies in show business history. It's called George Lucas's Blockbusting, and we'll talk to him about movies large and small. Join us.
Welcome back. Atul Gawande is a surgeon at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He's an associate professor at Harvard Medical School and the Harvard School of Public Health. He's also a staff writer at The New Yorker. I don't know how you do all this and write books as well. His latest book is titled The Checklist Manifesto, How to Get Things Right. We've had an email from Sheila in Baltimore, who says Dr. Gawande mentioned in passing a study at Johns Hopkins. How does his work relate to and compare to the work of Dr. Peter Pronovost, head of the Quality and Patient Research Group there? Dr. Pronovost has worked a lot with spreading the gospel of checklists to prevent hospital errors.
Yet Dr. Pronovost was the one who recognized that doctors should consider using checklists and devise that first set of checklists for intensive care units to reduce infections, first from central lines and then also from pneumonias you can pick up in ICUs.
That you talk about in the second chapter of your book.
That's right. And we basically stole his great insight that, you know, the idea is of checklist really for professionals originated in the world of aviation. And the hard part, the hard sell is that you can't reduce medicine to a recipe. It is patients are too individual, too unique. And if you just try to command control that this is the exact way we'll do everything, we'll fail. But the insight that we got is the recognition that it's about making teams work very well together. There are some dumb things you never want to miss in an operating room, antibiotics, getting blood ready, and so on. But then you get to that interesting stuff about teams working well. And these are insights about how you get a good committee meeting to go work. Make sure everybody knows each other's name. Make sure that everybody's clear about the goals. In this case, what you're about to do over the next 5 hours or 3 hours or, you know, could be a 12-hour case. And it's amazing that we have not built in that kind of discipline and consistency. And Peter Pronovost's work at Hopkins, and then it's begun to spread to other places, are implanting this idea that self-discipline comes from checklists and culture change, a culture that embraces this idea of self-measurement and of discipline.
Let's go back to the phones to Bar Harbor, Maine. Hi there, William. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you. My question actually follows that comment really nicely. I was wondering what – I'm a medical school applicant, and I was wondering what you, Dr. Blundy thinks med schools and hospitals can do to select physicians who will accept criticism from people lower on the rank. I think the checklist proves that hierarchy isn't always the best in patient care, and that's all.
It's a great question. This isn't about selecting the right people. It's about training people the right way. In medical schools, we've taught people to be individual superstars. You read everything you can about the physiology, know everything you can about the pharmaceuticals and about the kinds of treatments you can provide, and make sure you have it all in your head. What we don't teach people is at a critical moment, all that information is not going to be there in your head. You are fallible and you're going to fail somebody because of it. And so what are your strategies to deal with your own fallibility? The second thing we don't teach in medical schools is the knowledge and complexity has increased so much you're constantly working in teams. I was fascinated by the first medical school I've heard of to take on an interesting idea. University of Nevada at Reno has combined their medical school with their nursing school, so that there are actually courses that doctors and nurses take together. And in the course of that program, they're starting to even institute the ideas that there would be team training. Pilots go through simulator training where they go through disasters and how they'll handle themselves, not just as individual captain of a flight or co-pilot, but teams, including the flight attendants and everybody working together. You know, all of us run into exactly these situations in medicine and many other circumstances beyond medicine, but we don't take that lesson, but we can now.
It was fascinating to talk with Captain Sullenberger about that very idea of teamwork and how wonderfully that rescue occurred once he landed in the Hudson. So that kind of teamwork was clearly in place. Pardon me. I want to ask you about our concern, growing concern, about the lack of primary care physicians.
The concern is completely legitimate, and it goes to the heart of the same kinds of problems that led us to not in our healthcare system that's driven by getting good fees for doing radiology exams, for doing surgery. The result is we don't reward thinking. and spending time talking to people. The irony is that at this point, a doctor's time is actually less costly than the technologies and machinery we depend upon. And it is proving to be vitally essential to making care that is better organized, less fragmented, preventive remedies going in place for patients. And so our world right now, where we have given the wrong incentives, made primary care work incredibly hard, has led us to an undersupply. Medical school students don't want to go into primary care. At Harvard Medical School, it's become used to be the most common specialty. It's now under 15%.
Wow.
And in a country where we're about to cover a significant part of a population, we are now going to have to make sure that we are building the kind of manpower that can supply good primary care.
So what kinds of incentives do we need to apply to those who would undertake the hard work of primary care?
There's two things. One is that in a system that is trying these experiments where we shift from paying fee-for-service to making a global payment to doctors and hospitals as teams to take care of the diagnoses of patients, we're quickly rediscovering how important the role is of primary care folks, almost project managers that can make sure. The average American now, by their last year of life, has over 10 specialists involved in their care. And if there's no one knitting it together, all of us have had this experience, you can't get the doctors to talk to one another and get the things straight. Well, we're rediscovering that, and the financial incentives change that. Second, Massachusetts, a couple years ago, we covered our whole population. There's been a shortage of primary care physicians, and the result is the market has really increased the value. You're seeing increased salaries, signing bonuses, and organizations that are making their lives slowly, trying to find ways to organize it so that their lives cannot be as hard as they are. Because it is, all medical fields are hard, but primary care has found it a struggle to make it an enjoyable practice because of the dominance of all the paperwork we all deal with and other problems that get in the way.
Of course, the other problem there is the amount of debt that a medical student comes out of school with, and with lower salaries being paid or lower income for primary care physicians. How do you correct that imbalance?
Yeah, you think about the moment when a young doctor is making the decision about what specialty to go in. It's at that moment that they've accumulated $200,000+ worth of debt. Their payments are actually starting to come due to pay during residency. And you're imagining a world in which I, as a surgeon, can make 3 to 4 times as much as a primary care physician, depending on what specialty I go into. A radiologist can make double or more. And no surprise, some of the most popular professions are the more highly remunerated. It's not that everybody has to be paid exactly equally, but this kind of stark divide can't be there. There are a couple approaches that people are taking, including I think the fundamental larger financial incentives are going to shift this over the next decade, just because the ways we're about to change making payments in the system will change the values here. But I also think that loan forgiveness programs are going to become an important part of the answers, especially for those going into the most needed specialties.
Interesting. All right. Let's go now to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Steve. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. Really love today's show. I wanted to tell you a brief story about my uncle who went in for a surgery for a tumor in his lung, and the surgeon operated on the wrong lung and actually took out 60% of the healthy lung. So he was on oxygen permanently after that and didn't know what was wrong until he went to the hospital group and asked for his medical records, where they had actually crossed out and doctored some paperwork, and one of the nurses warned him to know that. So he, but what happened was, the malpractice insurance company, the hospital group, the doctor, the hospital, they all circled the wagons, and the attorneys delayed the court because they didn't want him wheeled in a wheelchair, you know, on oxygen when he filed this suit. And actually, he died about a year later and never saw his day in court. And so I think there has to be some culture change within the medical industry. They have to accept some responsibility when there's some errors, especially when it costs someone their life, like my uncle.
It's a devastating story, and not the first time. That's what makes it even more heartrending. These kinds of cases, I fear them. I fear what this could exactly happen to me. The most common reason that this kind of case will occur is that we will miss our check. And every day, I'll do five cases in a day. You get into automatic mode, and if you miss those checks, you see it drop through. That said, I did a study of these kinds of cases, and one of the patterns was that about two-thirds could have been caught by checks, but about one-third also had to do with problems that you never could have caught in the operating room. We rely so much on imaging nowadays, for example, to know where a tumor is. That I'm a cancer surgeon. This is a big part of what I do. And mislabeling of films, or just errors in how the films are printed so that you get a backwards image. These kinds of problems could turn up in about a third of the cases.
A backward image could cause a surgeon then to operate on the wrong lung.
That's right.
But what is isn't the surgeon seeing the tumor?
So by the time you go in, if you have a cancer, your whole goal is to remove all the tissue around the tumor. And if it's not invading out of the lung or out of the thyroid or out of the colon, in a colon you can feel it. In the lung you may not, especially if you're getting to do it with our minimally invasive capabilities,
right.
You know, where we can go in with a fiber optic camera and just remove what's there. I can tell you when that surgeon felt that tumor not in there, it would have been a devastating moment.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. To Hastings, Michigan. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning, Diane. My question and comment is directed toward Dr. Gwande about the how about a checklist for retaining qualified doctors in hospitals or hiring? A case in point, short story, my wife is a qualified board-certified surgeon. With emphasis on vascular and visceral surgery and trauma. And she's also board certified in family practice. She decided she wanted to work emergency medicine, which she's doing now. And she's being replaced by a less qualified, not even out of residency, ER doctor for the simple fact that they want board certified. And that's it. That should not be the only qualifying factor for a doctor.
Sounds like a pretty difficult particular situation. I don't envy the job of people who are trying to build the new system of the future. You're trying to bring staff in, make their lives better, and have very high standards that we're trying to achieve. And at the same time, we have a very competitive market for this world of getting talent in. And what you see everywhere you go, my father was looking for someone to come to rural Ohio. He's a surgeon in Ohio, retired, and there's no other urologist for miles and miles. And in order to get folks to come to rural Ohio, even though offering a very high salary to come, he found himself cutting corners in the kinds of folks he would be willing to look at, folks who'd been fired from other places before.
I see.
Because you had a need that was there. Mm-hmm. You do have to draw the line in at some level. But I think we also have to recognize this is not just about individuals, but making teams of people where we're measuring our results and looking to see what happens. When we start to see poor results, that's when you then have to look at the systems and people involved.
I have left this email until last because it's somewhat off topic, but I do want to hear briefly your comments on solitary confinement in U.S. prisons.
Mm. I'd written an article in March of last year where I've been always interested in where the individual meets the system, and that's partly the interest in checklists, but also was an interest in looking at what is it about the psychology of what happens to people in solitary confinement? I looked at the science of what happens to hostages and found that the studies have shown when folks like John McCain spent years in solitary confinement, or Terry Anderson, the AP reporter confined for 7 years in Beirut, that there are actually brain changes that occur in hostages in those situations. Number two, there was no clear difference in the experience of solitary confinement for hostages or American prisoners. And then number three, our use of solitary confinement in American prisons has exploded in an unusual way. It's a generational phenomena. There was virtually, it was a rarely used device under Ronald Reagan. By today, we have 50,000 prisoners in long-term solitary confinement. In many states, it's 5 to 10% of their prison population in solitary confinement, inordinately expensive, and I couldn't help but conclude from the science that it's torture.
Atul Gawande, he's a surgeon at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. His new book is titled The Checklist Manifesto, How to Get Things Right. I hope we can learn from your book, Dr. Gawande. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the chance, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.